Okay, so I think the rest of the people log on when they log on, but it's good, we're back to Thursday nights. All your smiling faces on the screen, or pictures, or letters of names, but all with us together here on Pesach on Chol HaMoed. And I know we're all busy already cooking and preparing for the second days of Yontif. So the fact that we're all here in some capacity or another is very special. That we're keeping the consistency in our limud as we go through the second perek, the second chapter of Makos. I'm just going to mute where the noise is coming from. Nothing personal. Oh, my muting power did not actually work for some reason. Okay, everyone, if you have noise in your background, just mute yourselves. I'm not sure why I can't mute. Okay, so we left off on the top of Ches Amud Aleph. We left on the top of 8a. Okay, on the top of Ches Amud Aleph, 8a. And the Gemara were 4 lines from the top of the page. And the Gemara is going to give us a case that is important for us to just review very briefly what the machlokis, what the dispute was in the Mishnah on Zayin Amud Beis in the page prior. So what we learned last time was that in the Mishnah on Zayin Amud Beis, it said that there is a machlokis, a dispute between the rabbis and between Rebbe, how we determine the case of the Torah. The Torah tells us the case of someone who kills Beshoge, someone who kills another person inadvertently. It wasn't an ones, he could have made some extra preparations, he could have been a little bit more mindful, but it definitely wasn't deliberate murder, and it wasn't complete negligence on his part. So he said, what is the paradigmatic case of the Torah? According to majority opinion, there's two lumberjacks, they go into the forest. One lumberjack, he takes a swing with his axe, but then the metal part of the axe, the blade, detaches and then flies off and embeds itself in Shimon's head. So that's the case of inadvertently killing someone in the Torah that sends someone into exile. They don't get put to death, they go to exile. The second interpretation of that verse in the Torah was Rebbe. Rebbe's position is that actually what happens is that the lumberjack, he takes a swing at the tree, right? Zadie, last thing we're telling you is you go side by side, you make the V. So at one time he takes the swing and then a splinter, like a piece of shrapnel, a splinter from the tree comes off, shoots off it at a high velocity, and that piece of wood from the tree embeds itself into Shimon, into the other lumberjack, and that's what sends the person to Gullus. Rebbe's case is a little bit more of a chiddush. It's a little bit more of a novel explanation because it's less direct. Because think about it. When I swing my axe and the metal detaches and hits someone, that's a direct action. Rebbe is taking an extra step. Rebbe's telling me that if the lumberjack, he hits the tree and then a piece of the tree comes off and hits somebody, that also will make someone liable and culpable to the extent that he is sent into exile to atone for his sin. Why do we need to know this introduction? Because the Gemara on the top of Ches Amud Aleph, 4 lines from the top, addresses this point. Amar Rav Papa. Rav Papa posed a scenario. Man deshoda pisa ledikla, someone who throws a clump of dirt at a palm tree, va'asar tamri, and then some of the dates detached as a result. Ba'azal tamri v'katol, and the dates come off and they hit somebody and kill him. I'm not really sure, dates are, they're not the most lethal objects, so it had to have been at a particular angle, at a particular velocity. Machlokis to Rebbe Rabbanan. This comes to Machlokis to Rebbe and Rabbanan. Rabbanan, they would say, I'm not culpable, because that's an indirect action. I didn't throw the dates at somebody. I threw something at a tree, and it happened that the dates detached themselves from a tree and hit someone. It's a grumma of sorts. Whereas, according to Rebbe, this is analogous to the case of the Mishnah, the case of the Torah, where I hit the tree and a splinter of wood shoots out and hits Shimon. This is analogous to that case, and Rebbe would say you're chayiv. The Gemara asks, though, sorry, if I could just finish this thought, I'll take questions after this piece. The Gemara asks, Pshita, what do you mean? This is such an easy analogy. Why did Rav Papa have to teach it to us, right? And it's, obviously, you know, you don't always want to say what's obvious to one person is not obvious to the next, but it was obvious at least to the Amoraim in the Gemara. So Madatema Koa Kocho Dami. Kamash Milano. I would have thought that maybe even Rebbe would concede that this is a case of koach kocho. What's koach kocho? Koach means strength. So my strength, when I, you know, hit the tree and the wood comes down and hits someone, Rebbe says that is viewed as a direct action on your part. It's not two separate. It's not you hit the tree and then the wood just happens to come out and hit somebody. No, you're chayav for that. But I would have thought to say, maybe, according to Rebbe, it's not analogous. That if I throw something at a tree, and then dates happen to detach and hit somebody, maybe that's one step too much removed that I wouldn't be liable for killing that person to the extent that I'd be sent into exile. Kamash Malan comes along the Gemara and tells us, according to Rebbe, it's analogous, it's similar enough, and you're held accountable. Now, one last little piece just to get us to the Mishnah, and then I'll pause for questions. Ela koach kocho l'Rebbe heki mishkachas la. So if that's not koach kocho, what in theory, according to Rebbe, Rebbe's the one with the very broad interpretation of what's considered a direct action, of what we could trace back to as your action, your deed. What is a case where Rebbe would draw the line and say, there's just so many steps removed, we can't call this a direct act of murder or manslaughter on your part. So the Gemara gives us an example, a sort of convoluted case to prove the point. Koach kocho l'Rebbe heichi mishkachas la, where do we have a case of koach kocho, the force of your force, that is not attributed to your direct action? Kagon dishada pisa. So you throw a clump of dirt, and then it hits a bunch of branches. And then these branches, right? Step one, throw the clump at the branches. Then the branches detach and hit. Step two, they hit the dates. And then the dates detach as a result. And then the dates hit somebody and kill them. Rebbe would say, at that point, we can't attribute that as a direct action on your part. It's two steps removed because I only detached the branch. I caused the branch to dislodge from the tree. The branch went ahead and caused the dates to dislodge from the tree, which thereby killed Shimon. So since it's two steps removed, we call that koach kocho. That's not attributed to me directly, and therefore I would not be sent to Gullus as a result. Do I have to do some tshuva for it? Maybe, maybe not. We can talk about it closer to Yom Kippur. But that is a case so far removed that everybody would agree. Even Rebbe would concede that you're not chayav to go to Gullus. You're not obligated to go into exile for such an accidental deed.
I don't agree.
You would agree, Zadie? Okay, no. you're good company with all the Amoraim.
Okay. But when you cause a branch to detach, you know it's going to hit something underneath it. And there are dates hanging on a branch underneath it. It's going to, with its force, it's either going to knock that other branch down or it's going to knock the dates off the branch. There's a good chance of all that happening. Then we come to the situation of Shimon, who gets hit by a splinter of wood. I don't see any liability there at all. Everybody knows, especially lumberjacks who are in the business, that when you chop a tree down, splinters of wood are going to go flying. What's he standing so close for? That it's a normal thing. You chop wood and splinters are going to fly.
Right. So I think this is a little bit, you know, not, these aren't just shavings of wood that are coming off. You'll forgive me if I don't have the precise terminology down pat, but this is a little less common for a splinter of wood, a big splinter of wood that shoots out at such a high speed to kill somebody. But like you said, it's not the most unlikely thing either. So I like what you're pointing out. You know, until this point, we've always viewed Reuven, the, I guess the murderer, for the lack of a better term. Murder is a strong term. The person who commit manslaughter. So we always view him as the active party, and we view Shimon, the victim, as the passive party. But Zadie, I like what you're pointing out, which is maybe Shimon has some responsibility to make sure that he is not too close to his fellow lumberjack. He could have taken some precautions as well. So that's certainly a good point. I don't see – the Gemara doesn't raise that over here at least, but your point's well taken on that. Certainly if Shimon didn't practice basic social distancing that is common in that profession, then possibly Reuben would not be liable if he didn't maintain the industry standards. Phyllis, I think you had a question before, right?
Yeah, I did. And then afterwards I started thinking, this reminds me of Chad Gadya in a way.
Right. Then this thing hit that thing, which hit that thing. Yeah. There's a connection to Pesach. Thank you.
Right. I was wondering, I don't know anything about legal issues, but is it like somebody would say, I mean, I don't know what the legality is, but like, what do you call it? Now I can't remember. It's not murder, but it's
manslaughter is a term, right?
Manslaughter. But what comes after that?
Negligent homicide.
No. There's another. The
Jeremy's term.
Stage one, stage two, why can't I think of
first the degree, second degree?
Degree, right. Like first degree, second degree, or third degree. It sounds like that's
it's a similar notion. I think in every legal, I mean, again, I'm not an expert myself, but I imagine every legal system has different categories for distinguishing different levels of killing someone based on intent and circumstances. So we're learning the Gemara's categories of that, but I like the analogy that you're drawing. Okay. Anyway, that was
I think the language that she's talking about is being negligent versus like recklessness versus intentional.
Right. Negligence versus recklessness versus intentional. Okay. So I think,
it's not intentional. We know that. It's got to be.
Right. There is something, what Jenny's pointing out, the term negligence, we have something which is called pshia, negligence, which is karov lemezid, which if you're so negligent that it's just like half a step away from being deliberate. So we talked about that last time. The Meiri said that you won't get capital punishment, but because it's worse than a typical case of inadvertently killing someone with shogeg, you don't get the protections of the city of refuge. So you could go into exile, but the Golei Hadam, the relatives, can still come and kill you nonetheless. So that's that middle stage over there. Okay, anyway, this is actually the Gemara that I hope to finish last time. So you forgive me, I think we got to move on to the Mishnah for today. So the Mishnah continues in this topic, unless there's something, again, that's very unclear that I could just clarify. Was anything unclear from the last piece that I can address?
Rabbi, what page are you starting now?
We are in Chesem and Aleph on 8a, and we are now at the Mishnah toward the top of the page. Okay. I'm not sure if an art scroll is to the first power or second power, but you should see where the Mishnah is. That should be easy to find.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to talk about other permutations, other cases of gullus, of deeds that someone commits that would send him into exile. Meaning killing b'shogeg. Okay, so again, I might not translate this so frequently because it's replete throughout the Gemara. That is our topic. Killing b'shogeg. B'shogeg means inadvertent murder. Okay, so it's not something that's out of my control. It's something I could have been a little more careful about, but it's not deliberate either. That's what killing b'shogeg is. And then gullus is going into exile. Like, we're in gullus right now. Okay. So someone throws a stone into a Rishus HaRabim, into a public area. Imagine, right? You're going through the Grade A Veldati's parking lot. You come by your car, and he's like, chuck a stone into the parking lot, and bam, it hits somebody in there, right? Good chances. Areza Gola, you'll be sent to Gullus. You'll be sent into exile. Now, why only exile? Why not? Why is it not worse than that? We'll talk about that in the Gemara. Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov Omer, Imeshayatsaha Evan Miyado, Hotzihalas Rosh of a Kipla Hareza Pater. So I was just talking to Marissa today and I was saying, you know, I need a better hobby than just playing Call of Duty video games on my phone. So I was trying to think of like a good, like active sport to do. So I was looking at videos of knife throwing on YouTube. And Marissa said, absolutely not. I was like, I don't know. You know, you need it for self-defense, anti-Semitism. I was trying to like make up all the reasons in the book of why it was okay. Lamai said we need a backyard first in order to do that. So it's a moot point. But imagine, right? Imagine, God forbid this should ever happen, but I'm doing knife throwing and or axe throwing. That's a popular thing these days. You go axe throwing. So I throw the axe. No one's there. Fully clear path. It's heading straight into the bullseye of the target. And then someone just, you know, almost like in a sitcom kind of way, sticks out his head. It's like, oh, hey, what are you doing over there? And then, bam, slices his head clean off. Forgive me for the imagery, but I think it helps. So what happened was, originally, I threw the axe. It was not going to kill anyone. I did not commit a Maisa Ariga. That was not a murderous action. But then Shimon, once the axe was in midair, he sticks his head out, and then the axe hits him as a result. I do not go to Gullus. I am exempt, and it's very logical. I did not commit a murderous action. Shimon, rather, stuck his head out and caused himself to be makabel, to receive, be on the receiving end of that axe. Again, well, we'll Rabbi, elaborate on all these things. If I could just get through the Mishnah, we'll elaborate on all these things in the Gemara. I'll pause after the Mishnah just to take any questions, but let's get through this. Zorag is a even lechetzro v'harag. If somebody throws a stone, now not into a public domain, not into the Beldani's parking lot, but you threw it into somebody's backyard. You threw it into a courtyard. In yesh reshus lenizik lichanes l'sham gola. So if the victim was allowed to be there, he was allowed to be in my backyard, that in that backyard at the time, then I'm held accountable, just like any case of accidentally killing someone. The imalav eno gola. But if he had no business being in that backyard to begin with, he wasn't invited to be there. He was there stealing somebody's bike, or he just happened to be walking through and trying to use it as a shortcut to get to somewhere. So then in that case, the mazik, the person who threw the axe, who threw the stone, is not culpable. He's not guilty because the nizik, the victim, had no business being there to begin with. And that's not called victim blaming either, apparently. So Shenemar, and we derive this from the verse, Bashir Yavo Esreehu Bayar, that he and his friend, it's talking about the case, the classic case of killing Bishogeg, that Shimon, Reuven and Shimon go down to the forest together. Mayar Rishus L'Nizik L'Mazik Chanesham. So the paradigmatic case of the Torah of the forest, a forest is public property. Both Reuven and Shimon are allowed to be there. So anywhere where both the killer and the victim are allowed to be there, that is where a case of killing Meshogeg and thereby being sent into exile can take place. Whereas to the exclusion of a chatzer of the owner, where the nizik, the victim, had no reason being there. If he had no business being there, he was not permitted to be there, then, you know, obviously we would hope that it wouldn't have to lead to it, but it's his problem. He shouldn't have been there to begin with. Had he not been trespassing, he would not have been killed. So that is the important exclusion that we learn from the verse. Now, just one more idea. Let's just get to the end of the Mishnah. Lots of important principles in here. Abba Shalomer, Machativas Eitzim Rishus, Afkol Rishus. Another important principle that we derive from the paradigmatic case, from the paradigm in the Torah of going into Gullus, of killing the Shogeg. Chopping down wood as a lumberjack is a Dvar Rishus. Remember, was it last month? It couldn't have been last Monday night, but 2 Monday nights ago, we talked about whether eating matzah over Pesach, other than the first night, we asked, is it a mitzvah or is it a reshus? Remember? So we talked about a reshus. A reshus is something that I don't have to do. Reshus is something I'm allowed to do, but I don't have to do. So going down to the forest to chop wood is something I can choose to do, but I don't have to go down to a forest and chop wood. That's up to me to decide. The case of where the killer, where Reuven will be held accountable for killing Shimon accidentally, inadvertently, is where Reuven and Shimon were there by their own volition. They didn't have to be there. Yotza Ava Makis Benova Rabba Rodas Tamino Vashef Basin. However, a father who is disciplining his child, or a teacher who's disciplining his student, or a shliach based in, the guy who gives the wits and based in, and he accidentally kills the person in the process, since they are performing a dvar mitzvah, since they are performing something they are obligated to do by God, they actually, if they inadvertently kill someone in the process, they are not sent into Gullus, because that does not fit the paradigm of the Torah, which is lumberjacks in a forest, which is a voluntary deed, a voluntary activity. Ad kan the Mishnah, that brings us to the end of the Mishnah. Let me pause here. Do we have, a lot of the questions we have might be addressed by the Gemara, but let me pause just to take what your questions are, and I'll let you know if it's addressed in there.
I don't understand something, Rabbi. If you go into a public place and you throw a stone or you shoot a bullet or an arrow, it's a public domain. What right do you have to do that kind of a thing? You have to assume, if you're in a public domain, that somebody might show up, even if you didn't see them.
So, Frechter and Phyllis, Akasha, the first Kasha of the Gemara. Very good. Phyllis, you're on the ball. This is perfect. That's exactly the first question that we will ask, that the Gemara will ask. So you and the Amoraim know exactly what to ask on this Mishnah.
I see a greater complexity than just that question, because there are certain dangerous activities which you are allowed to engage in a public place. For example, operating a motor vehicle on a public road, or we're talking about being in the woods or an open field, public land, or private land that you're on by consent of the owner, and you're hunting with bow and arrow, with a rifle, with a handgun. You see a deer, you take aim, you don't see anybody in the area, you shoot. Meanwhile, somebody is coming in from outside your view and they get hit, or the bullet goes deeper into the woods where you can't see the person and hits them.
Mm-hmm. There's a way to alert.
You haven't been negligent.
You can alert. You can make sure that there's nobody around. There are ways in which you could do that.
Not totally.
You play a bull, a horn or something, or you do something.
Then the animal's going to run away.
Well, okay, so then go to another place. Shoot.
Now they got the same situation in another place.
Well, I think there are some. Like operating a motor, a car. Yeah, you have to assume that you know how to drive and that you can do this. And that
somebody steps off the curb in front of you.
Well, okay, so that's why we have negligence lawyers for that kind of thing.
That's why we got Toby Schieffer and Jenny.
Yeah,
okay.
Here we go.
A negligence lawyer wouldn't make money on that one.
Right. Jenny, you look like you were waiting patiently with your hand up.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess the difference that I would see from a public policy perspective of why it should be different for someone who gets hurt in a public domain versus someone who gets hurt in a private domain has to be based on one's own, how do I say this? Based on, like, if you are putting yourself out in a public place, you kind of have like less protection than if you're keeping yourself in a private, like you have a greater sense that someone isn't going to like throw a stone into your property. You can reasonably expect that kind of like right of quietude. Whereas if you go out into a public place, like you should have your wits about you. Other people owe you less duty, basically, I would think, in a public place. So I would also, I was taking the counterpoint to what Phyllis was saying. And I'm not looking at the at the Gemara tonight. So I don't know if that's like correct or if I'm totally wrong, but that's, well, that would be my guess.
To a certain degree, you know, to a certain degree, though, the main distinction we should keep in mind is that in a public domain, the person who throws the stone, the onus is on him to be careful. And whereas in a private domain, so again, if the victim was allowed to be there, then it's the same as a public domain. You have to be careful. But if someone's trespassing in my backyard, I'm allowed to chuck as many stones in my backyard as I want. I'm allowed to, right? If I want to do knife throwing or axe throwing in my backyard, then my future hobby, when eventually Merce and I get a house sometime down the line and we have a backyard, I have room for it, right? So if you were not invited into the backyard, I mean, hopefully I'll be able to invite all of you one day, God willing. But meanwhile, during this time, no one's allowed to be in the backyard. Then you weren't supposed to be there. It's on you for being there.
Well, in this country, or at least in this state, that's not always necessarily the case. Ah. And for example, let's say if you have any knowledge that people on occasion do trespass on your property, then that gives you a higher level of responsibility.
You mean like a fence around a pool?
Like a fence around a pool, like a hole, in your yard that nobody would expect to be there.
I remember the attractive nuisance doctrine, right?
Yeah. Well, that's for kids. That's for kids. Oh. But even for adults, if you have reason to believe or that people might trespass on your property, there is some level of responsibility that you have.
Very, very fascinating. Now, this does come up in the Gemara as well. The Gemara does say that if you allow people to pass through your yard.
Not just of allowing, but even if you just have knowledge that it happens.
That's interesting. I don't think halacha would actually go that far. I think halacha might be a little bit more protective of our property than the state of Connecticut.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Judd, did you have your hand raised?
Yeah, I have a general question. You may have addressed this before, but logistically, how are things determined as to whether it's a private domain or a public domain in terms of the logistics of what happens with the Goel Adam? How is it prevented? Is the Goel Adam prevented, or what? How did that transpire?
So there are designated cities of refuge. I'm forgetting the exact number, but it's over 40 cities of refuge that are designated. So long as the killer who killed inadvertently remains behind the walls, remains within the general vicinity of that city, he is legally protected from being killed by the Goalei Hadam, from the Avengers of, not the superheroes, but the Avengers.
I meant something different. I meant, how is it determined that he's, isn't there a sort of like a little mini court case to determine that it wasn't a public domain? So,
I see what you mean. So the interesting thing is
there's a time interval where things can happen outside of control of the court.
So, you're saying what happens to him in the meantime before the whole court case goes down? So what happens is that the person, I think we're going to talk about this later, I think in the third parak perhaps, or maybe even earlier, I'm forgetting myself. But basically you go to Gullus preemptively, you go to the city of refuge immediately. Then when the court is set up, they escort you from the city. So you're kind of like on bail, so to speak, but you're in the city, so you're not exactly on bail. And they bring you to the court. And they have Torah scholars. It's interesting. They send Torah scholars with you to escort you. I guess they're hoping like, they won't want to kill the rabbis also. But you know, depends how fondly they think about rabbis. People have different opinions about people in my profession. Maybe it's a detriment. And then after the court case, it was determined that he actually killed Bashogeg and is liable to go to exile. They escort him back, and that's essentially what happens. So,
Rabbi, forgive me because I've missed a class or two. So although you've covered so much territory, I'm thinking I missed like a month, but I don't think so. Forgive me if this is something you've already discussed, but the language here about being exempt from exile, do they want to be exempt from exile? I mean, it's protective.
Okay.
So wouldn't they rather be going to exile? Because they're going to be, there's still going to be an angry family out there.
Okay, so the way it works is as follows. When we say someone is exempt from going to exile, it could be for a good reason or a bad reason. It could be either it didn't meet the threshold of negligence on his part, that he would be accountable for inadvertently killing someone. Therefore, the Goliadon would not be allowed to kill him. Or if someone is exempt from
that,
how do we protect him from the Goliadon? Like if they don't care about
that?
That I don't know about. I know about the legal protections. I guess he has to hire bodyguards then.
Mm-hmm.
If you know that the Goliadon were going to try killing him extrajudicially, then I imagine based on informs the town guard and they stop him. They inform the police or whatever the equivalent is. But we're assuming people are law abiding, which I guess not always a good assumption, but that is how we're operating.
Yeah.
Okay. We have a little bit of ground.
I have a question.
Yes.
If the person
we'll take this and then we'll move forward.
Is have to leave the community, go to another one. What happens if he's married, has family?
Yeah.
In other words, will he be able to work in that other community?
Ah, okay. So
support. It's more.
Nowadays, people work remotely. We have Zoom. It's possible to do that. The Gemara will talk about, I think, later toward the end of the chapter. Let's say he was in a position of authority. He had a governmental position, a hush of a position in his former life. Can he return back to his position of glory afterwards? So we'll talk about that. All great questions. We will address them, hopefully. But let's move on to the Gemara. We have grounds. This is Phyllis's question that got us down the rabbit hole. Phyllis asks as follows. Wait a minute. When I just chuck a rock into the Beldadi's parking lot and hit somebody, I should not only just go to Gullus to exile. It should be worse. That's basically like a deliberate murder. I know people are there, and I'm throwing a rock in there knowing it's going to cause damage. Why am I not held accountable? All right, Shmuel, it's a case of where, not where I was throwing rocks at people maliciously, but I was, I was taking down a wall. I was doing demolition work.
Yeah.
Okay, great. You're doing demolition work. You still need to be careful. No, I was doing demolition during the nighttime. It doesn't matter what hour you're doing at. You still need to be careful. Maybe some people at nighttime are still walking by. It's talking about a case where I wasn't doing it into Beldadi's parking lot, but rather it was right next to an ashba, a garbage area where people will relieve themselves. Hi, ashba. What kind of bathroom / garbage dump are we talking about? If there's many people that use this place, Hosheahu, he's negligent. Ilo shchichi barabim. Honestly, if this is a place that no one frequents at all, then he is honest. It's not something he could have foreseen. He was throwing a rock, or he was demolishing his wall into an ashba, into this garbage area where people do not use at night. Sorry, people use at night, but they don't use during the daytime. However, Vigut the Mikri V'yasid, there are a few people every now and then during the daytime who will use this area. So he can't be called negligent because it's not designated for daytime use. But onis nami lohavi, you can't call him an honest either, because every now and then people come. So the Gemara has to explain is where it's an area that is not designated for people to walk through. But he should have been a little bit more careful because every now and then there's that random Joe who walks through. So he should have been careful about that. Therefore, it's not bad enough that it's deliberate. It's not mazed, but it's also not honest. It's not like I could never have foreseen it happening. So therefore, it's called the shogeg. It's inadvertent, but he could have actually taken more precautions. Rabbi Lez ben Yaakov Omer, moving on to the next part of the Mishnah. Quote from the Mishnah, moving forward in Gemara. Tan Rabbanan, we learn a braisa. Umatza pralat mamsi asatz. Remember my case, I'm doing the throwing axes and the throwing knives. And then Shimon sticks out and says, like, oh, by golly, what are you doing here? Jeez. And then it just slices off his head. So umatza pratla mamsi is atma. Where do we learn the pasuk that if I throw something and then someone sticks out their head and it gets hit by it, that I'm not liable at all? Because it says in the pasuk umatza, and it is found. Pratla mamsi is atma, to the exclusion of someone who's mamsi is atma, who causes himself to be found, you know, to be found is a loose term, by the head of the axe. Mikan Omer Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Imishiyatza Evan Miyado Hotzi Halas Rosh Akila Pater. Therefore, based on this principle, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov taught that if I throw an axe, I throw a rock, and then after the release, it was a clear path, wasn't going to hit anybody, and then someone sticks out their head, that's not my problem. He caused himself to get hit by the axe. All right? So, Lameimra, but now the Gemara is going to ask a question based on the wording, right? We're trying to say, it says in the Pasuk, let me see if I can find it on the side over here. Matzah is, just want to quote it actually. The ish kilo yelo gil visiga yado matzah, oh, where is it? Okay, matzah esra'ehu, right? The metal axe, the metal head of the axe dislodges and then buries itself into Shimon's head. So it uses the term umatsa esre'ehu. The axe head finds Shimon. So matza implies that it was something. We are inferring that the word matza means something that was pre-existent, something that was always there. And therefore we're learning if Shimon then adds himself into the equation later, that's not my problem because Shimon wasn't there at the time that I threw it.
What found its mark.
Sorry, let me just finish this. Or minhi, but we have a contradiction. Umatza prat lematsoi. So very quick background. Moshe Rabbeinu, well not Moshe Rabbeinu, but I guess Moshe Rabbeinu served, and then Yeshua when they conquered Eretz Yisrael. The different families were given different ancestral pieces of land, and the Torah would like them to keep it. Every 49 years, at the end of 49th year, at Yovel year, at a Jubilee year, land returns to the original families regardless of sales. Now, if I am down on my luck, I do not have the money. I don't have the money to survive. I sell my ancestral field in order to make money, to liquidate it. And then later on, I win, you know, I score the jackpot, I win lots of money, and now I want to buy back the field. I am able to force the original buyer after 2 years to sell me back my ancestral field now that I have more money. However, if I had the funds to keep the field originally, but I just wanted to sell it to make more money to invest in GameStop, or invest in something else on the stock market, and I didn't have to sell it, then too bad, the buyer isn't going to be forced to sell it back to me. Now, how do we learn this from the verse? Umatza prat lamatzoi. Matza there means, and later on, he found money. Matza there implies not something that was found already, but something that was found later on, at a later point. Shalim korbarachov v'igol bekarov. Meaning you shouldn't try selling a land further away and then get back your field. And then selling a worse field at a later point in order to get back your ancestral field that you consider and you deem nicer. So the contradiction here is that we think matzah in our pasuk means that something was already there, to the exclusion of when Shimon then puts his head in front of the axe. But we have the opposite interpretation of the word matzah when it comes to the laws of ancestral land. There, we say matzah prat lematzoi. Matzah means he found money later on to buy back the land, to the exclusion of if he had money already to afford keeping the land, he can't force his way to buy it back. So I got an easy answer for you. Matzah doesn't have an intrinsic meaning of already pre-existent or found later on. Rather, you have to look at it in its broader context of the pasuk. Hasam yadikra umatza dumi devasiga yado masi yado mehashta af matzanami mehashta. You look in the verse talking about ancestral lands, it says vasiga yado, and he'll obtain more money. Okay, over there, obtain more money means he obtained in the future, later on. So matza there means he found later on. Hacha, but in our case of galus, minyadikra umatza dumi deyar mayar mi deisimi kara, just as a forest is something that was there already. Afu matza nami mi deisimi kara. We assume the word matza there also means something that was pre-existent. Okay, if we didn't get all the particular grammar and words, that's okay. The essential point that we need to come out with is that the word matza in the pasuk means I am only liable if I hit something that was there at the time that I did the deed. But if I did my deed and Shimon was not there, and then Shimon adds himself into the equation later and sticks his head right in front of the trajectory of the axe, that's not my problem. That's Shimon's problem at that point.
Okay. What difference does it make if it's a private domain or a public domain?
So the difference is that if all this happened in a private domain where Shimon was not invited and Shimon was trespassing, even if Shimon what happened to have been present and I, you know, inadvertently killed him based on the criteria that we've outlined, I would not actually be liable. So again, I chuck a stone into my backyard and, oh, whoopsie daisy, Shimon's there. I'm not expected to have accounted for Shimon being there because, frankly, Shimon was not supposed to be there. Okay.
I don't see the difference.
A little bit more flexible than Connecticut law.
I don't see the difference, but anyway.
What do you mean you don't see the difference?
I don't see the difference. I mean, as far as in the first instance, he wasn't there. His head wasn't there, and it all of a sudden appeared.
The difference in that case, we're talking about a public domain or a private domain where Shimon was allowed to be there. And by all rights, I should be chayiv. But it's another exception to the rule where if I threw something and Shimon was not in the trajectory, then puts himself in the path of the axe, then I am accountable. So those are two different qualifications.
I think what you're telling us is that if Shimon is in my backyard, I don't owe an obligation to be looking around to see if there's somebody who's there that doesn't belong there. Yeah. But in a public space, I have an obligation to know who's where.
Yep. I not just know who's where, but basically I have to assume that there's going to be somebody there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like what you're saying. Okay, we have about 15 minutes left. I want to try just in the next 10 minutes to finish the Gemara that we have allotted for today. And in the last 5 minutes, share some interesting additional ideas that I looked up. So just buckle up. I'll pause at the end of the Gemara. I'll take the final questions that we have, and then we'll conclude with some additional ideas from the Rishonim on the Gemara. Hazori gives to Evan. Amar le'ahu me'rabban le'rabim ma'ayit de'mechativas eitzim d'rshus, dil mechativas eitzim d'sugam mechativas eitzim d'ma'aracha v'fiu hachi amar achmona legally. So we inferred that if someone is doing a dvar mitzvah, if someone is performing a mitzvah, bless you, someone's performing a mitzvah and they inadvertently kill someone, they're not held accountable. Why? Because the case, the paradigm of the Torah is a case where I'm performing a voluntary activity of chopping wood in the forest. The Gemara asks, who says it's a voluntary activity the Torah is talking about? Maybe I'm chopping wood to build a sukkah. Maybe I'm chopping wood so it could be put in the ma'aracha, so it could be used to burn karbanos, to burn sacrifices in the temple. And the Torah says, even though I'm performing a mitzvah, I still have to go to galus. I still have to go into exile. So how are we inferring from the Torah that we're necessarily talking about a case of rishus as opposed to mitzvah? Chov. Amarle, that's not a good question. Why? Kim dim matzah chatuv lav mitzvah, hashanami lav mitzvah. The answer is that chopping wood for a sukkah is not a mitzvah. You see, there's something called a mitzvah and a hechsher mitzvah. This deserves its own separate class, and many classes, actually. A mitzvah is something that I'm intrinsically obligated to do. A heksher mitzvah is a means to performing a mitzvah. What's the mitzvah? The mitzvah is to sit in a sukkah. Arguably, maybe even to build a sukkah somewhat. But there's no mitzvah to chop wood to then bring it to build a sukkah. So it's an important thing to do, but it's a means to an end. It's not intrinsically a mitzvah. Also, chopping wood for it to burn on the mizbeach, they might already have wood. You know, the chopping the wood is not the mitzvah. It's a means to an end. It's important not to confuse the goal with the means to getting to that goal. So even if it is a case of chopping wood for a sukkah in the Torah, that's still not a mitzvah. Isve Rabbina Rava, but Rabbina asked Rava, Yotza av hamakis beno v'rava rodes tamina v'sheach beistin, leima came to ilu gomer lav mitzvah, hashnami lav mitzvah. So then the Rabbina asks Rava, but wait a minute, the case of a dvar mitzvah in our Mishnah, of someone performing a mitzvah, let's say a teacher right back in the olden days, this is, by the way, we're going to talk about this in a future Monday class. I have it docketed, God willing. We're going to talk about discipline in schools and whether corporal punishment is permissible in halacha, how poskim in the 20th century and 21st century have addressed the natural uncomfortableness with corporal punishment. But so we're going to learn the abstract now. We'll talk about the practical implications in a future Monday night class, God willing. So the question is same idea over here. Maybe if the student already learned his lesson and the child already learned his lesson, there's no intrinsic mitzvah for me to discipline my child. It's only to get, you know, my job is for them to do mitzvahs, to be observant, to raise them properly. If they are a good kid, they don't need any discipline. So maybe disciplining also is not intrinsically a mitzvah. It's just a means to getting them to performing mitzvahs. So the answer is no. Huge chiddush over here. Awesome. I thought God to come here. Mitzvah. Even if the kid already learned his lesson, it's a mitzvah to give him another whack. Why? As it says, I think it's in Mishlei, if I'm not mistaken, that if you discipline your child, he'll provide respite for you, and he'll also provide delights for your soul. So, you know,
is that the halacha?
That's the halacha.
Oh, come on.
Now, Toby, again, I said, we're going to do a Monday night class where I will explain that there are certain qualifications to this. So, but certainly without any commentaries or poskim, the way it's right now, I was hoping for a response like that. So I appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
So there you go. So that's the trailer. That's the trailer for the Monday night class that will come up eventually. You know what? Maybe we'll do it this Monday night, actually. Why not? Maybe we'll do it this Monday night. Just so it's connected to the topic. I don't want to leave everyone in suspense for a month. Okay. Moving forward, Rava has another answer to the question. Remember, the question was, maybe the Torah is talking about a case of chopping wood for the Mizbeach or chopping wood to build a sukkah. So maybe, even if you're doing a mitzvah, you still go to Gullis if you inadvertently kill someone in the process. Rava says, hold on, Rava. La milsehi da'amri. I got a better answer. Va'asher yavo esreya bayar. What's the word va'asher mean? That somebody and his friend will happen to go into the forest. Asher implies mayar di'boy ayil di'boy lo ayil. A forest, going there is voluntary. Bisagadaitach mitzvah misagid lo ayil. The implication of the word asher is, you know, again, you have to know Hebrew well, but apparently asher implies that what's happening is voluntary. What's happening is being done by someone's volition. They don't have to be there. Asher, I happen to have come there. I happen to have come down to the forest. If there was a mitzvah to come down to the forest, it wouldn't have used the word asher. I happen.
But isn't that the word that's used like in brachos, like asher kiddushanu b'mitzvah sav? That doesn't sound...
Yeah, so I mean, when it's Chazal, I think it's more like biblical Hebrew as opposed to Chazal creating brachos. But that's a good point. Asher Kishanu, well, that God just happened to have commanded me. That's a good call.
Yeah.
That's a good point. But that's apparently how they understand it, at least in biblical Hebrew, not in Talmudic Hebrew or Mishnaic Hebrew. But we'll have to ask Hebrew experts. Anyway, that's what the Gemara assumes. Amar le Rav Anna bar Havla Rava, Kolech Desiv Asher De'ibah, Kolech Desiv Asher, wherever it says word Asher, De'ibahu, it's voluntary. That's what you're assuming? It says in the Torah, and now those who are with us for Mishnayos Pesachim, you'll remember this very well. Those who are in the daily Pesachim Mishnayos, we got a few here. That if you go to the Beis HaMikdash, you go to the temple and you are spiritually impure, you are Tameh, then you get Kares, you get divine excision, you incur a punishment. The implication, but it says Asher in that Pasuk. Ibai mitma, ibai lo mitma. That implies that I had a choice whether to do something that would cause me to become tamei. But meis mitzvah delo sagi delo mitamei hachi nami depater. But the implication is that if I was forced to become tamei, such as a meis mitzvah, I saw someone, a corpse along the path, and I am obligated to bury it. I had no choice whether to become tamei or not, but I had to become tamei nonetheless. And the halacha is that I'm still not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash. But according to you, Rava, who is telling it the word asher implies voluntary, implies I'm not forced to do something, it's not compulsory, then if I'm forced to become Tameh, this prohibition of me entering the temple precincts should not be effective on me if I was forced to become Tameh, if you understand asher to be voluntary. Only people who came voluntarily Tameh should not be allowed to go in. So then why is a meis mitzvah, someone who had to become tamei, is not allowed to go into the temple? So Rav responds, Shani Hasam Damar Kura, Tameiya Mikol Makom, because it says in the verse, Tameiya, which implies, it basically, if I only had the word asher, I would think only those who became voluntarily tamei were included, but it has the words Tameiya, which imply that it doesn't matter whether it was voluntary, it doesn't matter what your choice was, it doesn't matter what your intentions were. If you are Tameh, as a statement of fact, you're not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to go into the temple. Ay, hahumi vayilei l'chitanya, but we need the words Tameiya, the extra words Tameiya to teach me, l'chitanya, as we taught in the Braisa, Tameiya l'rabos tavol yom, Tameiya, those words are used to exclude something else. Sorry, not, you're used to exclude something. To exclude someone who went to mikvah, but did not wait. He was tameh, he went to mikvah. He immersed himself in the mikvah, but he did not wait until the end of the day. He did not wait until it got dark. You have to wait until it gets dark to go into the Beis HaMikdash. You're not fully pure yet. And the words, tumaso bo, l'rabos mechusar kipurim. And it just happens to quote the rest of the Braisa, that the words tumaso bo tell us someone who did not yet bring karbanos, if someone was tamei and he was obligated to bring a sacrifice, he didn't bring it yet. Also, he's not allowed to go into the precincts of the Beis HaMikdash yet. Amar le, ana meotumaso kakamina. I derive that teaching from Od Tumaso. And therefore, I can use the word tameihiye to tell me that in the case of tuma, someone who's tamei, even if you were obligated to become tamei, you're still not allowed to go into the Beis HaMikdash, but assuming I don't have any additional terms implying otherwise, asher, the word asher, conveys a voluntary nature, and since it conveys a voluntary nature, we assume that the word asher is only when someone is involved in a voluntary activity, but someone's involved in a mitzvah, an obligatory activity, and they accidentally kill someone, they will not be sent to Gullus for killing B'shogeg. Now, I know some of the derivations from the words back and forth is a little unclear, but that is the essential point that we need to understand to move forward in the Gemara. That brings us to the top of Ches Amid Beis, of 8b, and we will conclude with that piece of Gemara. What I want to do over the next 4 minutes is pause for any essential questions, and then share one brief piece from the Rishonim on the Gemara. Are there any essential questions, anything I could clarify, just to make sure we understand basic pshat in the Gemara? Okay. So, because I prepared something, I don't want to keep us over time. So I just wanted to share what I have here. Few interesting things. So we didn't really elaborate on this, but remember we talked about it at the end of the Mishnah? One of the things that someone could do that's considered a mitzvah that will absolve them from going into galus is a shliat beistin, the guy who, you know, he gives the makos, who gives the lashes. If he hits the guy and he kills him, he does not have to go into galus. So there's two understandings of what happens in that case. One understanding is he lost track of the count, right? We're doing sphere right now. We can lose track of count all the time. So he overhit somebody one more than he should have given him. That's the approach in the Ravid. But the main consensus, the main approach, is that actually he was told the guy can handle 39 lashes. He gave him all 39 lashes, but it turned out the guy couldn't handle it. So there, actually, the Ramban says the patur, the exemption, is not because the Shliach Beis Din is involved in a mitzvah. Because one could say, Tosos brings up this idea but rejects it, that giving someone malchus is also not intrinsically a mitzvah. Rather, what, you know, if someone never committed a sin, we would never have to give them malchus. So maybe giving malchus is not intrinsically a mitzvah. So what's the betor? Why is the shliach basin? Why is the guy giving the lashes exempt? Because anasu. The Ramban says he's an anus because, look, the experts told him this guy can handle 39 lashes. I'm just following what the doctor said. If they got it wrong, that's not my fault. I trusted the experts. So therefore, it's not that he's involved in a mitzvah, but he's an anus. He's exempt because he followed the experts. The experts are wrong. That's not his fault. That's one idea I want to share from Rishonim. The one other thing I want to share in our last minute and a half is that there's a Tosefta, again, a very early rabbinic source that says that a doctor, I'm so sad, I'm squishing this into the last minute. There's so much to say here. A doctor who accidentally kills someone in the process of performing a medical procedure, they actually do go to galus. And the question that everyone asks is, wait a minute, healing somebody, shouldn't that be a mitzvah? You're saving another person's life. If a doctor's involved in a mitzvah saving someone's life, why do they go to galus then? Good question, right? So very briefly.
Get a better doctor.
All right, get a better doctor. So, right, if it was malpractice. So one opinion is, according to Aruch HaShulchan, look, you know, if the guy was doing malpractice, if he could have been more meticulous, but he was misrashil, he was just lazy that day, he didn't take all the measures that he could have to save and preserve someone's life, then, okay, so that's why, it's malpractice, he goes to galus. So that's what the Tosefta is talking about. But a very fascinating idea in the Gilyone HaShas says that actually, why is the mitzvah of healing somebody, or rather, why is healing somebody not considered a mitzvah, an intrinsic mitzvah? Because if someone had because if I had enough faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I had enough faith in God, I wouldn't need the doctor to heal me. So, of course, it's a good thing for doctors to heal people, but it's not considered a mitzvah because if I had enough betachon in Hashem, enough faith in God, I wouldn't need the doctor to heal me. Which, I'm just putting it out there. I'm not necessarily supporting that notion.
Then how come doctors get heterim to be Mechala Shabbos?
So Mechala Shabbos, I mean, well, right. Because so we assume most people don't have that level of bitachon, apparently, according to this pshat. I personally, you know, it's a Gilyone HaShas, who might disagree. I'm not personally compelled by that, but I thought it was a little bit of an amusing idea. So I thought I would share it just for our learning purposes. Anyway, this just brings us to the end. It's 9:01, I realize. So anyone who needs to go, thank you so much for coming. Yashar Koach, have a good Shabbos.
Thank you, and have a wonderful Yontif.
You over Shabbos and Yontif, God willing, either in the tent or in the chapel, wherever we may see you. I'll stay on for a few more minutes just to address any remaining questions.
Yontif to everybody.
Thank you so much. Chag Sameach, everyone.
Chag Sameach. Good Shabbos.
Zadie, you had a question.
Yes. A Rodev comes to kill me. Isn't it a mitzvah for me to rise up and kill him first, or to kill a Rodev to protect somebody else's life?
Yes. Oh, so you're saying is, why is that any different? So interesting, interesting point, right? That's the question, right? Why should I be any different than a doctor? So it depends, you know, I'll answer this off the cuff. It depends on your understanding of how Hashgacha Pratis works. You see, when you read the art scroll books about Hashgacha Pratis, about how divine providence works, they assume that nothing happens to you unless Hashem ordains it. But according to some Rishonim, part of having free will is that people can do things even if God does not ordain it to be so. God gives us free will. So if Reuven wants to kill Shimon, even if Shimon was not declared by God on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur for him to die that year, if according to a minority opinion of medieval philosophers, if Reuven wants to go ahead and kill Shimon, he could succeed in doing it unless Shimon has an abundant amount of merit to protect him from doing that. So I would say, according to that shot, maybe in a case of a rofe where I'm dying from a sickness, all I need is faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save me. But in a case of a rodave, maybe there needs to actually be action taken, because maybe faith would not be enough, even according to some of those opinions. Again, just conjecture. I think it's a difficult position to begin with. So I personally am not compelled by that shot. But since you asked based on that shot, I thought I'd give you some form of an answer to something I don't think is compelling to begin with.
Well,
okay. Does that address the point somewhat?
Well, you know, this is very interesting because in New York City, Manhattan, there are a lot of construction going on. And Mel always told me, stay clear from it. Don't be on the near it. Things can fall. You understand? And even though, you know, they have, you can walk underneath, don't. So I try to skirt all these places where there's construction, because you never know. If someone could be flying a half a block away,
and you can see it's rooted in the Gemara as well. So you have his architectural knowledge, you have the Gemara's points over here. It all connects. Okay, wonderful.
And I'll tell you something. Mel had to go on a lot of project he was involved in Manhattan.
This was his expertise. Never go,
even though the building is completed, he never permitted me. He said, rats. They haven't fumigated. Now you see.
My rule is.
I'm just telling you.
My rule is I avoid New York City in general. So I avoid all those problems. You
stay away from these things.
Stay away from New York City.
Thank you so much.
All right. Have a good Shabbos. Good Yontif. Have a good day. Thank you again for learning together. It's good to be back.
Thank you. Thank you very much.